Thanks, Desiree. Let's see, got it. Okay. My name's Tom. I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of a loving God, I've been continuously sober since June the 15th of 1986. And I'm very, very grateful for that date and always have been. I've never not been. And, you know, I was taught in the very beginning of my AA journey that gratitude is not a adjective, it's a verb, in that if you're grateful, you gotta do grateful. You know, you don't be grateful, you do it. And I hope that's what I demonstrate. I try to do that anyway. Sometimes I do a better job. My home group is called An AA Group. We're a big book step group. We're in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We meet Monday nights at the Salvation Army. If you're ever in town, we'd love to see you, and we really mean that. My home conference is called Fellowship of the Spirit in Colorado, started by Don Pritz and Mickey M 31 years ago, and I've gone every year for 31 years, and it absolutely changed my life. That 6 years sober changed the trajectory of my life. At any rate, in Santa Fe, they derogatorily call me a big book thumper. But I prefer to think of myself as a big book advocate. So that's, I don't know if you put that together, if that means anything to you. I have been mentored by some incredible people. One is Mary T. She was one of my first sponsors and set me on the right course. And the other, Don Pritz, and then, of course, Gary B., who's been my longest sponsor. I sponsor guys. I think everyone should. That's just my opinion. And I go through the steps. I try to go through all the steps every year. You know, there's a kind of a, well, there's two theories, I guess, schools of thought. One is you only work the first nine steps once, and then you live in 10, 11, and 12. And I think that's really great if it works for you. But, you know, we're talking about four and five, and I got to say, man, you know, from my first four steps to the ones I'm doing today, there is just a world of difference. And the book says more will constantly be revealed. And it certainly is if I make myself available for the revealing. And I believe in the working and reworking of the 12 steps. I had a grand sponsor named Paul Martin. I didn't talk about him. And he died with 63 years sober. He lived in Chicago, and he knew Dr. Bob, and he knew all of the early Chicago AAs. And he's the one who told me, Tom, it's the working and reworking of the 12 steps. Because the question I always ask when people say, you know, first nine steps only, is what's the perfect year to do the perfect fourth step, you know? And a lot of them say, well, you pick up all that stuff in the 10th step, but I don't think you do. It's not been my experience that you do, you know. So at any rate, getting off with a bang, I want to quickly say that I'm a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous at 37 years sober. And the reason is that I owe my life to God and Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm one of these that was... had I not gotten sober when I did in 86, I wouldn't have lived another year. And my doctor assured me of that. I was a walking dead man when I got here. You know, I always, you know, I can encapsulate this really easily. Bill Wilson, in the end of his story, he says, the alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. And I never did unlovely. I did knee crawling, snot slinging. Okay. Did not get here on the wings of glory by any means. I was 130 pounds, 6 feet tall, had hepatitis C long before that was popular. They didn't even have a name for that at the time that I got sober. And had four children that were terrified of me and a wife that hated me. And no friendly direction whatsoever. I had one friend, was my business partner, and I'd been stealing from him. So no bueno, you know, and I'll just leave it at that. But I owe so much to Alcoholics Anonymous that I can never repay it. And the journey to try and repay it has really been an interesting one and a really rewarding one. So that's the deal. So I did, I'm just going to share on my experience with four and five. The first four step I ever did, if you want to call it a four step, was in a treatment center in 1986. And it was a list of questions that a corporation that no longer exists called CompCare had made up. And I did that. And, you know, I just wrote down, you know, a few ugly things that I had done. And my first fifth step was in that treatment center. It was with an AA man that I had met in this little meeting that actually saved me, that grabbed me, 12-stepped me and saved me, that was held at the treatment center early in the morning. It was not a part of the treatment. It was an AA meeting. They paid rent. They were completely separate from the organism, you know, the treatment center. And this guy I'd come to trust just because his story was so gnarly and he had 6 years sober. And so anyway, I did a fifth step with him, and it was a paltry thing. I mean, because it wasn't an organized deal based on what the big book says. It was just kind of a hit and miss hodgepodge thing. But I tell you, it was one of the most important things I ever did, because I told this man things that I never told anyone. You know, I mean, I was 2 weeks sober when I was doing this, you know, so I didn't, my brain was a long ways from healing. I mean, like at least 2.5 years away from being what I would call healed. So I did the best I could, but I told him things that I had never told my running partner, you know, on drunken nights when we'd, you know, confess things to each other. And that was really important. I mean, I said things that I was ashamed of, mostly sexual stuff. And told him what I could. What, you know, I tried to be as transparent as I could. Not a big deal, not a really great one, but really, really important in my life. Okay. And so I came out of that, and I did kind of for the first six, I'm trying to condense this because I got a lot to tell you. For the first 6 years, I had a sponsor in the beginning who wasn't a step worker. And he told me if I wanted to work steps, I should get someone else. And I got another guy who sounded good at meetings. You know, when I was 2 years sober, he sounded like he really knew what he was talking about. And he turned out to be a very weird guy. Let's just say that. And when he told me I should leave my wife when I was 2 years sober, because his spiritual guides would tell me the woman I should be with. And I'd been married to Juanita for about 13 years at that point. That's when I said, no, that's too, I'll go with woo-woo, but that's way too much. And I got rid of him. And right after that, I got Mary Thayer, and that's her, that's like Mary Beth. Okay. And, she knew what she was talking about, and she was a very wise woman, and she helped me tremendously and got me on a good path and really on a big book path. She went back to Maine from New Mexico, and I was still talking to her every week, but I was hitting a wall that I didn't even know I was hitting at 5 years. And I've had a lot of surrenders over these years, but I had one at 5 years, and I was just like, there's got to be more to AA than what I'm doing. There's got to be more than meeting makers make it. You know, there has to be. If there isn't, I'm out of here. And so they say, you know, the old deal, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I heard a set of, I took a newcomer to Roswell, New Mexico, to a conference, and I heard a set of tapes by a guy named Joe Hawk, who was deceased. And it lit a fire for me that there was more to this than what I had been exposed to at this point. And so he was speaking in Amarillo, Texas that fall, that October, and of 1992. And I went out to Amarillo to meet him, and he changed my life. He sent me to Fellowship of the Spirit, the first one. He said, here's the deal. He said, how do you write inventory? That was the first thing he ever asked me. How do you write inventory? I said, you mean like CompCare or Hazelden? He goes, no, man. I mean, like, you know, the the way it's outlined in the big book, like the, you know, four columns for resentment, the columns for fears, and the nine questions of the sex conduct inventory. I had no clue what that meant. Can you imagine? At 6 years sober, I didn't know what that meant. And he said, let me show you. And he took a cocktail napkin and he wrote out the columns like on a cocktail napkin to show me the deal. Incredible. So at any rate, I went to Fellowship of the Spirit. I met Don Pritz. I met Bob O. I met Gary B. I met Mark Houston was up there. Just a bunch of people who became my heroes. And that's when I said it changed everything for me, because these people were doing it by the book, and they seemed happier and they seemed more alive than the people back home that weren't doing it, that were meeting makers making. And I wanted what they had. You know, when I went up there, I'd heard about big book thumpers. They're these mean SOBs that, you know, beat you with the book and ask you questions. If you don't answer it right, they, you know, give you a bunch of grief about it. And so I was a little apprehensive when I went up there. And, you know, what I saw was more laughter and more tears than I'd ever experienced in AA. And what I got was these people are really alive. Clint Hodges was one of the presenters up there on the ninth step. And man, he just lit a fire for me too. So many of these people. Sharon C., who some of you know, was the first female speaker there in 1993. And she was phenomenal. Anyway, they just lit a fire for me that there's more to this. And so I got into it and I started, you know, became a big book literalist, like crossing every T and dotting every I. And I don't do that any longer. I think it's the spirit rather than the letter. But at any rate, so I wrote an inventory that was the first one I had ever written based on what the big book said, you know, how it laid it out. And one of the things I always talk about this, you know, I've got 30 minutes to do this. I just did a workshop on step four in Santa Fe. It was a 2.5 hour deal. So I'm trying to like, rant. But what I saw in that first one that still stands out is my first wife, my former wife, who is a mother of two of my children. I hated her. I guess hate is too strong a word, but I really resented her because she had left me. Jump ship and taken my children away from me. And when I wrote that inventory, what became strikingly clear was that when in the fourth column was she had never left me. I chased her away. I developed a life that was untenable for someone to live in, and it was completely insecure, and you know, just devastating to her. And she had to leave. I mean, it wasn't that she ran away. I pushed her away. And that was a huge change. You know, the book in the, and I'll talk, if there's any time left, I'll talk a little bit about more about the fifth step and what happened with that first fifth step, but first big book fifth step, because I'd done others. You know, the book talks in the resentment inventory, it talks about, we look at people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. And that meant one thing when I first wrote it, like, you know, people, that's easy. My ex-wife, she left me. You know, the guy she ran off with, I hate him. I wanted to kill him. My parents, you know, they didn't raise me right. You know, the drill, just the typical stuff, on and on. Then it was institutions. Well, the IRS, I hate them. You know, the American military, you know, anything like that. Politics, you know, politicians, the various deals, churches, you know, all religions, you know. And so that, you know, was the institutions part. But the principles that I put down in the beginning were things that I couldn't live up to. There were things like an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. You know, give a man an honest break. You know, honesty is the best policy, things like that. And I couldn't live up to those things. So they pissed me off. Okay. So, I mean, it was that simple. You know, there was more to it, but it was that simple. And then later, as I would write inventory, like years later, the things that I heard, the trite parroted things that people would say in AA meetings that I knew weren't true. Okay. That became the principles that I was angry with. Things like just don't drink no matter what. Meeting makers make it. Acceptance is the answer to all my problems. All of those things, you know. You know, the thing in the ninth, this still pisses me off. The thing in the ninth step where someone says, well, you know, it said, except when to do so would injure them or others. And my sponsor told me I'm others. And if the men's is going to hurt me, I don't have to do it. And that's the worst BS I ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. Absolutely wrong. You know, just my opinion, but it's a good one. And so it was things like that. Well, anyway, later, you know, more recently when I'm writing inventory and I'm looking at principles, the principles become the belief systems that I've carried with me all my life that have never helped me at all. They're not from God. They're from some fear-based ego thinking. And they have retarded me in my life always. And they're usually from childhood, things that I heard that, you know, maybe I didn't even hear what I internalized, but I did internalize stuff and I've carried it through my life as a belief. You know, Mark Houston used to say, if you want to know what a man believes, don't ask him because he'll tell you all sorts of stuff, but watch what he does because his actions will, you know, express his deep-seated beliefs. And so ferreting those things out and looking at them, and the reason I resent them is because they weren't from God. They weren't helpful to me or anyone else, you know, the people I'm trying to help. They just held me back. Things like there's not enough. There's not enough money. I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough. I'm not good looking enough. I'm not spiritual enough. You know, I'm not a good enough AA. I mean, it's everybody has them and it goes on and on. And here's the kicker. You never get rid of them. I mean, you never get all of them out. But Don Pritz taught us to shine a light on the things that are in the darkness. And if you shine a light on it, you start to heal from it. And that's been my experience. So let me hit this real quick. Desiree, how much time do I have left? I'm kind of, I don't know. I don't know if she's there. I just see her picture. Okay, we'll do the best we can here. So this is on page.
Yeah, Tom, excuse me. You have 12 minutes.
12 minutes. Okay. So on page 62, it says, this is in the third step, right? They're starting this back then. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholics is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though I usually don't think so. Okay. And one of the things they taught me, the Denver people and the Colorado people, was to read the big book in the first person singular. And so that I could see myself in the book, and it changed the whole big book from some dry 1930s crap to like my autobiography. You get what I'm saying? And so that's the way I do it. The piece that I wanted to hit, this should get you guys talking about some stuff. Let's see. You will hear people, this has come into the parlance of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think the devil or the ego, you know, did this. It's just my thinking. But people will say, then I was willing to look at my part. You ever heard that? Anybody not heard that? Okay. You hear it all the time, right? Not what the big book says. You know, not what the big book says. What the big book says is, we went back through our lives and nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. Isn't that true? Those SOBs, they ruined my life. You know, it's all their fault, blah, blah, blah. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse, then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Okay. It's plain that a life that includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. I've never had a fun resentment. I've never been happy resenting other people. There's a sense of superiority sometimes when I resent other people, but it's never made me happy. But the bottom line is it's futile. I mean, I can dislike them. I can be angry with them. I can hate them, but it doesn't do a damn thing to, excuse me, doesn't do a darn thing to them, right? It you know, all it does is it eats at me, okay? And I'm a slave to the people that I resent. Let's see. This one always got me. It's plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. Here's an equation they give. To the precise extent that we permit these, meaning resentment, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? I was 38 years old when I got sober. I mean, my kids had grown up, you know, and I wasn't even there for it. I mean, because I was drunk all the time. And I squandered half of my life. And when I read that, I thought, I don't want to squander any more hours in my life. I can't afford to, you know, if I'm going to be here and do this. But let me get down to this real quick. There's prayers that I always say when I'm writing inventory, and between the third column and the fourth column, which I didn't have time to go through, but there's prayers in the book that I say for each and every person or institution or, belief system that I'm carrying. This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. We ask God, which is a prayer, to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. If you ever read the original manuscript, Bill had written that, a sick friend with cancer. Now, why they changed that, I don't know, but I really don't know. But I understand it, you know, that if you get the fact that people don't do these things because they're having a wonderful day and they're spiritually, you know, fit, but they, like myself, do these things because they're spiritually sick. It's a real game changer. We avoid retaliation in argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. You know, that's a promise. I was in Belfast, Ireland about 2 weeks ago. And I don't know if you've ever heard of Sister B. She's the Irish nun that has been speaking in AA for 40 years. And she says there are 126 promises in the big book. For don't, you know, cheat yourself with the nine of the that they read from the, you know, ninth step. Look for all of these promises. But here's the kicker. This is what I wanted to get out. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done. Okay. Putting out of my mind the stuff that they have done. Okay. I resolutely looked for my own mistakes. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely my fault, I tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Okay. Where was I to blame? The inventory was mine, not the other man's. When I saw my faults, I listed them. I placed them before me in black and white. I admitted my wrongs honestly, and I was willing to set these matters straight. Okay, so here's the thing that I think. I believe that the ego convinces people to say, what was my part? And this is the reason. If I say, what was my part, I'm referring to a whole, and you still have a part. You understand what I'm saying? I'm admitting, yeah, I'm at fault, but I'm not completely at fault. And I want you to know that. Do you get what I'm saying? Does this compute? It's not what was my fault. It's not what was my part. It was where was I at fault. And if I'm still blaming the other person, then the whole thing doesn't work. You know, the whole dynamic of it collapses. Because what I'm doing is I'm still blaming the other person. Here's the deal that I've come up with. The ego wants me to say, yeah, I've got a part in this. You know, I messed up, you know, for sure. But you did too. And I'll hang my butt out and be at fault as long as yours is out with me. Because I'm not going out there by myself. The ego doesn't want me to do that. You see what I'm saying? And here's the other, I'm going to do this workshop in Idaho this weekend. I'm going to talk about this a lot. I believe that the ego wants me to think that if I resent you, I have some power over you. I'm defended against you. That it somehow helps me if I can keep that resentment going, if I keep that anger about you. The truth is, it rots my soul. It doesn't defend me at all. There is no defense. And instead, it's killing me inside, is exactly what it's doing. You know, it's not what was my part. It's where was I at fault? And I got 5 minutes. Okay. I kind of wanted to finish with that, but all right. Resentment is the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else. We've seen this. If you've been around like I have, you've seen people go out and die who were in AA because of resentment, because they were right. You know, there's an old thing of, do I want to be right or do I want to be happy? And that's wrong, because when I'm right, I am happy. If I can convince you I'm right for a minute, I'm happy. Okay. But the real deal is, do I want to be right or do I want to be free? Because I'm enslaved by my own rightness. Okay. The real quick, since I have probably 4 minutes, in the fear inventory, I go through it and I say, what was the fear? Okay. It might be a fear of dogs, let's say, or a fear of women or whatever I'm afraid of. I'm afraid of dying. I'm afraid of ill health. I'm afraid of running out of money, whatever it is. Okay. The next question is, why do I have it? Okay. And that's like logically, well, dogs bite people, you know, well, if I don't have any money, I could, you know, be destitute, you know, on and on. And then the third column, we do a 4-column inventory. We take it from the big book. The third column is, how did I try to have power over this? I've forgotten the exact words in the big book, but wasn't it because self-reliance failed me? Like, how have I tried to have self-reliance and use self-reliance to defend myself against this fear? Okay, and I do all sorts of funky things, and I can see that in the third column. And then we do a fourth column that we call the better way, because the big book said, perhaps there's a better way. We think so. The way of trusting and relying upon God. So what I do in that fourth column is I say, if I were to trust and rely upon God, what might this look like? And, you know, I have to tell people all the time that, you know, I'm not free of fear. I have fear every day. Every human does, you know, but I'm not enslaved by it. I'm not paralyzed by my fears any longer. And, you know, this stuff really does work. In the sex conduct inventory, you know, we're talking about Don earlier. He used to say that they hid a relationship inventory by calling it the sex conduct inventory. And it works for all sorts of stuff. The 9 questions in the sex conduct inventory you can use for, you know, like a 10th step, you know, like a written 10th step, that kind of a thing. You know, you get bound up, you do the 10th step stuff, and you still can't get rid of it. And you want to do some writing, you can ask those questions, you know, in terms of whatever it is, and in relationship to whatever, you know, you will see some really interesting things. And also, it's about sex, like, you know, how have you used sex? What have you done with that? You know, blah, blah, blah. Let's see, I've got 1 minute, 37 seconds. You know, the big book said we had to be free of anger. You know, going back to the resentment. And I thought it meant I have to never have anger. Like, I have to be the spiritual giant that is just like on an even keel at all times. That's not what it said. It said I have to be free of it. Okay. I can't be enslaved by my anger. I'm going to have anger if I'm a human being. It just happens all the time. And now I am down to 1 minute. That's a little unnerving, that thing. But I think, you know, I've said basically what I wanted to say. I hope you've gotten something out of it. Thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it. I'm done, Desiree.